The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
That weighs a ton. Well, not actually. You know, you look at me and you go, well, yeah, maybe 20 pounds, maybe not even that, but that's hyperbole. When I said that, that's hyperbole. And you all know what hyperbole is because you use it from time to time. You might not think about it in that particular term, but you use hyperbole. You're talking with someone and it's not going very well, and you say, "You never listen to me." Well, if that's actually true, then why are you talking to them? Why would you even bother to say that if, in fact, they never listen to you? Or someone will say, "And I died of embarrassment." And you're hoping that the EMS were there in order to revive them so they could tell you about how they died of embarrassment. We use hyperbole. Hyperbole is the overstating of a truth for the purpose of capturing attention in a vivid and compelling way. Hyperbole is the overstating of a truth. It's not a lie. It's an overstating of the truth in order to capture attention in a vivid and compelling way. Jesus, in fact, he used hyperbole. He says in Matthew chapter 5, if your eye causes you to stumble, then pluck it out. And you know what? There's no account in the Gospels of one-eyed disciples following Jesus. It's not that we should ignore what he said, but we need to understand he says it in a compelling and vivid way to capture attention and provoke response. Why mention this morning? Solomon uses hyperbole. And it's important to recognize that. I mean, in fact, let's go back to the very start of Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes chapter 1. If you have a copy of the scriptures, which I hope you do, I'd love for you to turn with me to Ecclesiastes because we're going to spend a lot of time there this morning. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 starts this way: the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. All is vapor, all is breath, all is chasing after the wind. Now think for a minute. If that's absolutely true, then why would Solomon write? If everything is vanity, then even his writing would be worthless, right? So it is hyperbole. It's an overstatement of the truth in order to capture our attention and in a compelling and vivid way so that we pay attention. Grasp what he's saying. When you hear those words, vanity of vanity, everything is vanity, you should be going, what can that mean? Why would he say that? Because that seems a little over the top, and we would go, yes, hyperbole is a little over the top, but it's not. Don't hear what I'm not saying. Hyperbole is not lying. Hyperbole is not lying. It's merely an emphatic way of making a point to capture attention, to awaken us out of our inattentiveness. The second thing is that you need to remember is that Solomon doesn't use hyperbole entirely throughout the book. But there are moments where he says things in an over-the-top kind of way. It's important, I think, as I'm reading Ecclesiastes, to notice this, because if I don't recognize that there are times he uses hyperbole, it's easy to conclude Solomon's just a depressed and depressive guy. And that's why some people don't read Ecclesiastes, because they go, it's just like such a downer to read Ecclesiastes. And it's because they don't recognize there are times when he is saying things in a really compelling, kind of over-the-top way, emphasizing what he wants us to understand by using hyperbole. And we need... The reason why he uses hyperbole is because we need to be shocked out of our complacency about how we think about life. Do you understand? We need to be shocked out of our complacency. I got life figured out. I know what life is all about. Solomon goes, no, I'm the wisest, and he's not bragging. He is the wisest man that ever lived because God told him he would do that. He is the wisest man who ever lived. And he said, if you think you got it all figured out, you don't understand a thing about life. So the reason why it's important to recognize this is because it's going to grip us and draw us into Solomon's thinking. A little bit of review to get us up to where we are this morning. In chapter 1, Solomon lays out this idea that everything is happening under the sun. He's talking about life on the planet. Everything is happening under the sun just like it always has. The sun rises, the sun sets, and you know what happens tomorrow? The sun rises and it sets. What about the day after that? The sun rises and it sets. And the wind blows and it doesn't end up blowing and blowing away. It blows again. It talks about the rivers in chapter 1. The river flows into the sea and then the sea's not filled up, and yet the river keeps flowing. And he's talking in chapter 1 about the permanence of creation. It just continues to happen the way it is. And he asks the question, so what's the profit of what you do, what I do in life? He goes, it never changes creation. So his argument in chapter 1, the point in chapter 1 is, the conclusion is, I have seen everything under the sun, and behold, everything is vanity and striving after the wind. What does he mean by that? If we assume our labor under the sun actually changes the universe, someone goes, that's just foolish. That's just striving after the wind. It's vain to think that. So then, picking up on that, in chapter 2, he unpacks this idea. So if, in fact, I think my labor impacts the world and changes the world, and it doesn't, chapter 2, he goes, so then, what about this pursuit of wisdom? Could you get enough wisdom and enough understanding to make sense of what's going on in this unchanging world? Will a pursuit of wisdom and a rich life of experience provide full insight to the meaning of life? If I just get enough wisdom, get enough experience, get enough knowledge, will I understand my place in the unchanging world? Solomon says, I did all of that. I experienced all that. He had the riches to do that. He experienced all of that. What does he conclude? He says that that exhaustive pursuit of experience is never-ending and unsatisfying. He says you can't come to fully grasp everything that's going on. Not saying that there's a pursuit of wisdom is in itself striving after wind, but if you think, Solomon goes, if you think you're striving after wisdom will ultimately answer your questions, he goes, it's striving after wind. So he can say in chapter 2, verse 24, there's nothing better for a person that he should eat or drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Because he says, if you think the pursuit of wisdom will in fact bring satisfaction, I've done it, I've decided, I've concluded, it is like running after the wind trying to catch it. So, if we then live each day as it comes to us, and we just content ourselves to living in each day, will we then grasp what God is doing in our lives? That's chapter 3, where he talks about the times. Well, if you read back chapter 3, verses 1 through 11, you'll notice that those times don't go in one direction, from bad to good, from bad to good, from bad to good. No, it goes from bad to good to bad, and then back and forth. And it seems really confusing. It's not like there's no pattern. What happens if I'm living well my daily life? Will then I grasp what life is all about? Will the pattern be seen? He goes, no, it won't happen that way because the pattern isn't evident. Look at what he says in chapter 3, verse 11. God has made everything beautiful or appropriate in its time. He's also put eternity in man's heart. We long to have an eternal perspective. God's done that. He's put eternity in our hearts. Yet, he's done it so that man cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. Oh, if you think that as you're living your days, you'll see the pattern, you'll figure it out, you'll know what it's all about. He goes, no, God has worked in such a way that you won't see that. God has purposely worked in such a way that you won't see that. So what's he doing in chapter 3? This is the conclusion that Solomon offers us. I perceive that whatever God has done, this is 3:14, I perceive that whatever God has done endures forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken away from it. But God has done it this way so that people fear him. So if you think, okay, an exhaustive pursuit of wisdom won't do it, but if I just live daily life really well, it'll start to make sense. And Solomon says, I've done that. I've looked at it. And you know what? I can't discern the pattern. And in fact, it was God's design that I couldn't discern the pattern so that I would come to fear him. So fearing the Lord, this is the first time he mentions it, fearing the Lord has something to do with seeing God as the biggest and the grandest and the most valued and the most significant thing in life, even if you can't grasp what he's doing. And so Solomon is saying, driving us in the over-the-top kind of way he's explaining life, for us to realize so much of what we strive after is, in fact, striving after wind. It doesn't produce the kind of satisfaction that we want. And God has orchestrated life that way. And I think that when I got to this point in chapter 3, I thought, well, really? Is it really the case that I don't see as much as I think I see? Well, Solomon lets us in. 3:14 is something of a conclusion to what he's been writing, but then when we pick up in 3:16 and following, he backfills. Why is this the case? Why is this the case that you won't always see what life is like? So let's read, picking up in chapter 3, starting in verse 16. Moreover, I saw under the sun, daily life. He's not talking eternity. He's talking about how we live our daily lives. Moreover, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, even there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, even there was wickedness. So I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. But what is he saying here? He's saying, under the sun, daily life, yeah, ultimately God's going to judge the righteous and the wicked. You know what? That's not typically my struggle. My struggle is, today, where's justice? Today, why isn't righteousness being played out? Solomon goes, I've seen everything under the sun. It looks like at times justice isn't served. Righteousness isn't honored. Wicked people get away with stuff. You ever feel that? You ever? Gosh, it's like Solomon was reading our minds. Or, since he's the wisest man who ever lived, God gave him that insight. He knows what life under the sun is like. So he says, it seems at times under the sun that justice and righteousness don't play out, even in life, even if we fear the Lord, even ultimately that righteousness is going to be played out. Daily life, it seems really hard to understand that. So he picks up there. Chapter 3, verse 18. I said in my heart with regard to the children of men that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. For what happens to the children of men and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for it's all vanity. And all go to one place. All are from the dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? What's he saying? He's told us under the sun that looks like justice and righteousness don't always play out. But then if we live well, in the end, we'll be able to look back at our lives and see how it's played out. He goes, no, you look back at the end of the life and everybody dies the same. In fact, he goes, it's just like the beast. Everybody dies. The beast died. Everyone goes back to dust. And you kind of go, well, then how do we make sense of life? If, in fact, at the end of life, you can't look back and go, this was my significant life as compared to others. He goes, no, everybody dies the same. He says, I've seen that. Everyone dies the same. And then we kind of go, so how are we then to be living, Solomon? Look at what he goes on to say in chapter 4, starting in verse 1. And again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one able to comfort them. And I thought, the dead are already dead. They're more fortunate than the living who are still alive. Notice, again, hyperbole. Obviously, if the dead who are dead, they're no longer alive. They're not experiencing anything under the sun. A little hyperbolic, a little over the top. It'd be better to be dead, because then you wouldn't see this trouble. But better, verse 3, but better than both is he who has not yet been and who has not seen the evil deeds that are... Well, if you've not yet been, then you can't ever see anything. So again, he's making the point, do you understand that as you look at life and you experience life and it doesn't make sense, everybody's in the same boat. If you're an oppressor, that is, if you're trying to... Okay, life is a struggle, justice is not always served. Could I not just gain everything that I can while I'm here in my toil? It would make sense then to make the most of what you can in all the days that you have, exerting yourself and power over others to gain. And he goes, that's delusional. There'll ultimately be no comfort in that. I've seen it. Even exerting yourself over the will of others so that you can find comfort in life, he goes, ultimately you won't find it. So he's thinking out loud with us. Chapter 4, verse 4. Then I saw that all the toil and all skill in work comes from man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and striving after the wind, and the fool folds his hand and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after the wind. What's he saying here? If in fact there's no comfort in using your power to suck as much life out from others as you can, he goes, well, let's not just do that. Let's just labor well. But he says that even the laboring well is often tainted by envy and rivalry. If he were writing to us today, he would say, just look at your Facebook posts. No, Facebook is about connecting with people, right? And you put your worst pictures up there, right? You put your most horrible experiences up there on Facebook, right? What do you do even when you're connecting with people on Facebook? Is this not a degree of envy? And you never look at the Facebook posts and go, oh, snap, look at the vacation they're having. You never do that? Yeah. Solomon goes, I know. Even before Facebook, he goes, I know. All of our striving is about envy and rivalry. Again, a bit hyperbolic, a little over the top, but nevertheless, there's truth there, right? There is truth there. Even I'm not going to oppress others. I'm not going to be in competition with others. I'm just going to pursue my own life. But ultimately, it's driven by envy and rivalry. He says the fool then concludes, it's useless. I'm not going to do anything. And he says the fool consumes his own life. But that's not satisfying. So not oppressing, but rivalry, it's there. It's not satisfying. So then chapter 4, verse 7. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or daughter, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. So if I'm following his thought, it's like there's not justice and righteousness, so I'm just going to have to fight to make sense of life myself. And he goes, that's not satisfying. The oppressor nor the oppressed are ever satisfied. Okay, no oppression, just rivalry. And he goes, that's useless. That's vain. Okay, no rivalry, no competition. I'll just look after myself. I'll be like Scrooge in A Christmas Carol. Just after myself. Isolation, no oppression, no rivalry. The way forward is just look out for me. And he goes, that's futile as well. You'll never find comfort there. So then he picks up in chapter 4, verse 9. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. There's the challenge of being on your own. Verse 11, again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. So he's suggesting, so there might be a benefit of doing life with others, but he doesn't stop there. Look at how he continues to explain it. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end to all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and striving after wind. And you kind of go, I'm having a hard time following this. It's okay. Solomon's the wisest man who ever lived, so it's not surprising that sometimes we have trouble following his thoughts. What's he saying here? He says, yes, there is some benefit to doing life with others. But then he offers this picture. What about the king who had all this support and all this love and all this commitment, this relationship stuff that was going on in the kingdom? And then he says, so a poor lad who used to be in the prison rises up and he becomes popular and he dispossesses that king. What happens to the king? He's no longer loved. And now this poor kid is now the king. What's going to happen to him? Afterwards, people are going to come up who don't prize him any longer. So what's Solomon's point? It's not wrong to pursue life with others, but if in fact that's where the meaning of life comes from. He goes, ultimately people are fickle. Well, you don't know that? Oh, why are you smiling when I say that? Because you've experienced that, right? People who used to be in your corner, used to support you, and for some reason, they no longer do that. If in fact that's where I'm anchoring my life, then ultimately you find also that can be futile, that can be vain. Solomon says that even those kinds of relationships, though they can be beneficial, may well be fleeting. Not saying there's no benefit to doing life with others, but the question is, what are you pursuing in doing that? So from 3:16 to 4:16, what's Solomon helping us understand? We don't see life playing out just Can you say an amen to that? Yes, we don't see life playing out as just. All men, even those we perceive to be good, they die like everybody else. We go, well, yeah, that's true. So then fighting others to get everything you can out of life, that's really satisfying, right? No, we know that's not true. So just resigning to look after myself and just me, there I will find satisfaction, right? No. He says, no, you won't. So then if I link arms with others and together we try to make sense of life, then I'll get my answer. No, because of the fickleness of others and their struggles in understanding life, all of these things are ultimately striving after the wind. Not that there's not some good there. But if we don't feel and grasp and see what Solomon is driving at, we won't get to where he wants us to go. Our sense that we know, I know how to make sense of life. I know how to understand this beautiful order of life under the sun. Solomon goes, no, you don't. Your sense that you think you know will ultimately prove to be unsatisfying. Solomon, experiencing more of life than any of us have experienced, with a gift of God-given wisdom that exceeds any of our wisdom, advises us that we are at risk of striving after the wind if we think on our own, as we pursue wisdom, as we pursue justice, as we pursue obtaining, pursue life for ourselves, as we pursue life linking arms with others, if we think therein, that's where we're going to find meaning. If we pursue life that way, Solomon wants us to understand it's not going to be that way. Now listen, it's not that Solomon doesn't say we see some things. Notice what he said. Solomon has said that enjoying what the Lord puts before us every day is good. See that? Enjoy that. He's also said, we just read it, one day God will judge the righteous and the unrighteous. We should recognize that. But the truth is, I need Solomon to take me to a place where I can feel and see and understand what he came to feel and see and understand. Look at, back to chapter 3, verses 11 and following, to pick up again what Solomon wants us to grasp. God has made everything beautiful, and it's time we say, yes, everything is appropriate. God has designed it that way. And he has put eternity in our hearts. Do we want to have a sense of where it's all going? Yes. And yet, God has so worked that we cannot find out where it's all going. I have some sense of today. But even if I know the ultimate destination, God has so worked that I don't know how I go from today to the ultimate destination. I may know that's where I'm going. But God has so worked that we don't know the beginning from the end. We don't know how it's all playing out. That's what Solomon is wrestling with. The angst of knowing it's going somewhere, knowing that God is good, but today life is hard. Today life doesn't make sense. And Solomon says, you could try all these things to try to make sense of life, and if that's where you're putting your confidence and trust and rest, you will be striving after wind. Because not only has God, chapter 3, not only has God worked in such a way that we won't know the beginning from the end, but he has done that so that ultimately we fear him. In fact, friends, I would suggest that what Solomon is recognizing is, if in fact you felt like you had the plan to figure out the meaning of life under the sun, why is your life unfolding the way that it is? Then ultimately, two things. Ultimately, you would rest in your grasp of the plan. You trust the plan and work the plan. But God has ordered such things in life in such a way that you don't know the plan. That's actually a good thing, because the result then is it forces you to someplace else. Where's the someplace else? Fear God. Depend on him. Rest on him. You don't know the plan. It was a gracious thing for God to do that. Because otherwise we'd live as if we got it figured out. We do know something. We do know something about where life is heading. But our angst, my struggle, Solomon's wrestle, is to grasp the dailiness of the struggle under the sun when it doesn't make sense. Do you ever feel that? When someone's four-year-old daughter dies, and a well-intentioned believer says, God is working all things together for good. I want to slap that person. I'm just saying, that's true. But the angst that the person is feeling when their four-year-old daughter died of unexpected consequences, to know the destination is not helpful in the angst of the day. Yes? This is what Solomon's struggling with. That's what we're struggling with. I've been reading the book of Job. It's where Job lives. Job says amazing things. We're told he's a perfect and upright man, one who fears God and turns away from evil. There's no man like him in all the world. God says of Job, he never sinned in the things he said. And he says things like, I know my Redeemer lives. The Lord gave, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Job says that. Job says, I know I will see him. So what's Job's struggle? We go, he just didn't know what was going on. The fact is, you know what was going on, because you read the book. If you read the book, you know what's going on. God never told Job. God never told Job. In fact, Job wouldn't have had the capacity. See, we think we have the capacity to understand everything that God is doing in our lives, right? That's why we're frustrated. Why don't you tell me everything that you're doing in my life, God? God goes, it's really gracious that I don't do that, because if I did that, your brain would explode, right? Job's struggle is, I know some things. And he's right, he knows some things. You're right, you know some things, but the struggle isn't the things you know, it's the things you don't know about how life is playing out. And Solomon goes, that's where the struggle is. And if you think you've got it figured out, Solomon is saying, you're delusional. You're striving after wind. You're trying to grasp vapor, because God has so ordered things that you won't know all of that, so that you will fear him. That's why he uses hyperbole, to get my attention, to waken me out of my slumber of thinking, I know this, Job, I know this. I think I have the capacity to understand this. Now, Solomon has more to share with us. So you get to come back, because this isn't everything he has to say. But I want you to, this morning, I want you to feel what Solomon is feeling here. I want you to, in a sense, be cornered the way that Solomon is cornered. Solomon, wise man, brilliantly wise man, gifted with wisdom, riches and opportunities to explore it all. He concludes, I don't see it all. It's arrogant for me to think I got it figured out, if Solomon doesn't have it figured out. So he says, what I'm seeing is that where God is going with us, all of this, is that we would fear him. Now, chapter 3 is the first time Solomon mentions the fear of God. He hasn't explained it all. So if you come back in the next few weeks, Solomon is going to explain more and more about what it means to fear the Lord. But at this point, I think there's a couple of things in Ecclesiastes that are helpful. A couple of things to notice. A couple of hints, in a sense. So far in Ecclesiastes, Solomon has not unpacked everything about the fear of God, but this is the thing that he said. He did tell us God makes everything fitting or beautiful in its time, even though you don't know how that fits. Okay, that's part of the foundation of the fear of God. He has made everything beautiful in its time, even though I don't know how it all fits together. Causing me to lean on him. The second thing that he has said is, God has the end in mind from the beginning, even if I don't understand the journey there. Okay, I know I'm on a journey that God is orchestrating, and he has the end in mind. I don't know. I know where it will end up. I do not know how to get there. So then I will have to fear him, trust him, rest in him. Third thing is that God has given you today. Remember what Jesus said? The way we're supposed to pray is, give us this day our daily bread. Why do you think Jesus encouraged his disciples to pray that way? Because we don't have the capacity to know about monthly, yearly, lifelong bread God gave us today. So then if God gave you today, God knows how to go from today to the end and you don't. God knows the full plan and you don't. God knows how it all fits together and you don't. And Solomon goes, I guess the thing to do then is to fear him, to depend on him. So we could live, Solomon says, we could live as if God is the biggest, the grandest, the most valued, the most significant thing in life, even if we don't grasp how it's playing out under the sun. I know when people read Ecclesiastes, they go, it's really confusing. I don't think it is. I think it's really provocative. And because I like to remain comfortable, I don't want my world to be upset. I don't want the apple cart to be overturned. I don't want to feel like I don't know. Ecclesiastes is really confusing. No, it's convicting. It's provocative. Drives me to a corner that I don't want to go. Do I want to go to the corner when I have to say, I don't understand how it's playing out? That's true, you don't. Solomon says you don't. I know where the destination is, but I don't know how to get there. Solomon goes, that's right, you don't. I only know about today. Solomon goes, that's right, that's a gift from God. So then what am I supposed to do with the rest of my life? Live as if God himself was the biggest, most valuable thing in the world. Then you could live today in the fear of God. In the sense, find yourself growing free from the angst of being the master of your own days. I don't think that's actually very confusing. I just think it's really provocative and very healthy. Let's pray. I want you to respond, not to me, not even to Solomon's words, but to the Spirit's words through Solomon. I anticipate, as we listen to Solomon, different little triggers go off in your soul, little different things buzz in your head. And you got to come to grips with those. Don't ignore where the Spirit of God is pushing on you through Solomon in good ways, healthy ways. Talk to him about that. Just spend a minute or two admitting, confessing, discussing, affirming what the Lord is saying to you. Respond. Don't just listen. Sovereign God, would you awaken in us by grace and by the Spirit a growing understanding of life under the sun, the way Solomon saw it? Would you dispossess us of the ways we think life should be going, so that we can hold much more loosely our plans and thoughts about life and hold much more tightly to you. I thank you that you have not either revealed it all to us, given us the map to walk it out, because then I'd be resting in me, which I do plenty of already. So, do a grace work, a kind work. You've designed life in such a way that we would know you're faithful, but that we could fear you. Help us to live there. This would be good for our souls. Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child the repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.